This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Thursday of this week, somewhat like New Year's Day for the state of Iowa, it's the beginning of the new fiscal year, new budget, salary changes, among other things, new laws taking effect. One of the new laws puts a lifetime ban on guns for people convicted of certain crimes. Another one brings free preschool to more Iowa four-year-old children. A speeding fine costs a lot more, but hopefully won't be seeing drivers sending text messages as their vehicles speed by. That's illegal beginning Thursday. The same for teenage drivers using cell phones. We'll be talking with experts on these subjects and with you, too, on our toll-free lines. It's The Exchange, right after the NPR News. It's Dean Borg, continuing with The Exchange. Now, we're talking about new laws taking effect in Iowa on July 1st. And one of those new laws relates to driving. We've heard a lot about the cell phone driving and texting while driving. Well, the state of Iowa has enacted some new laws, and they go into effect on July 1st. We're going to be talking about those laws with Tim Brown, who's the senior team leader for cognitive systems at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. And then later in the program, we'll be shifting to other guests and new laws that are going into effect and getting some of the nuances of those new laws, talking here for the first few minutes, though, with Tim Brown about distracted driving. Tim, you conduct a lot of research on drivers by simulating highway conditions and actions by drivers. What generally have you found about what we call distracted driving?
I think the evidence is pretty clear when you look at distracted driving. When we take the driver's eyes off the roadway, we're seeing a significant increase in reaction time. So we're seeing safety implications. So texting is an ideal one. You know, you look over and look at your cell phone, right, your iPhone, and your eyes are off the road for sometimes up to 6 seconds while you're reading what somebody had sent you. It also applies to email, you know.
So you think the new law is good?
The new law is needed. You know, we've got we know that distraction is a problem. The Department of Transportation at the federal level has declared this an epidemic. You know, we know that people are dying on our nation's highways because people are distracted when they cause an accident.
These new laws in Iowa, the two that we're going to be talking about here, is all distracted driving, of course, but it puts the force of law and penalties behind two specific actions. One is texting, which you've just been talking about. The other is using a cell phone if you are a youthful driver within a certain age range. As a researcher of driving skills, you think that this goes far enough?
That's an interesting question. We know that on the teen side, you know, with novice drivers, they have enough trouble driving. You know, they're in the process of learning how to drive, how to interact with traffic, what's important to look at, what's not. The last thing we need them doing is either looking at their cell phone to dial it, to have conversations with people on the cell phone, or to be texting. We know that they don't have the spare resources that are necessary to drive safely in those early days, let alone to...
Well, I'm pointing at you right here because I'm going to ask a very pointed question,
okay,
and that is it better? Are they less able to use a cell phone than a driver who's 30 years old?
Well, I don't think that they're less able to use a cell phone. I think they're less able to drive and use a cell phone. And when you look at that, we know that from research, that first 6 months of driving is the most dangerous time in a driver's life. They're 10 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash during that first 6 months than at any other point in their lifetime. And we know that, you know, having a teen who's learning to drive, there's just so much they need to pay attention to. They can't spare the resources that are necessary to have a conversation on the cell phone.
Are you telling me this because you've personally witnessed this on the highway, or that you have put teen drivers in the driving simulator and given them real highway situations and you've seen the reaction, or are you going by what you've heard?
A combination of things. We've done some research looking at teens and distraction. We're currently analyzing some data from a study that looks specifically at teen and interaction with and performing distracting tasks. Also, one of my colleagues here at the university, Dan McGehee, over at the Public Policy Center, they've got an on-road study where they're collecting video of drivers as they of teen drivers when they have an emergency event. You know, there's a large acceleration from braking too hard or steering too hard. And I've seen, you know, from a research standpoint, we've gone through those clips, and you know, distraction is a significant factor in those sort of things.
And have you seen a difference between, let's go back to the 30-year-old or the 60-year-old, a difference between a teen driver and those ages?
It depends on the level of distraction. There's certain tasks that are just, you know, when we talk about the texting, you know, that's really a task that no one should be doing while they're driving. The cell phone, talking on the cell phone, is a little more ambiguous from the research. We're seeing an increase in risk associated with that, but it's not the same level of risk that you see with texting and driving. And so I think you can make some differentiations, which is, I think, what the legislature did. They looked at it and they said, you know, this we know is really bad, and this is bad for everybody. This, on the other hand, which is the talking on the cell phone, there's some dangers to it, but it doesn't rise to the level of some of the things, other things that we're going to create an outright ban on.
Your title here is Senior Team Leader for Cognitive Systems at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. That's a very technical term, cognitive systems.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Does that give you some special expertise in these questions that I've been asking?
It does. The area I do research in is related to how the driver interacts with their environment, with a particular focus on how they do it from a cognition standpoint. So what are they capable of doing? And so my background is in industrial engineering and human factors, mm-hmm. With coursework also through the psychology department at the university. And so it's a good background to deal with this distraction area, because there's physical manual, which we know when your eyes are off the road to look at something, if you're reaching into the back seat, we know that's bad. You know, when you look at it from a research standpoint, we know that if your eyes are on the roadway, you're not likely to depart your lane, which is one of the primary types of accidents that people get into when they're distracted. Is, you know, kind of you run off the road, you lose track of the lane, and you either drift into the adjacent lane or off into the ditch.
We're going to have you on, as I know we're going to be talking about other laws that are not driving, and we're going to have you on for just a few minutes. But if there's someone listening who has a specific question about this, the number to call is 1-866-780-9100. Again, 1-866-780-9100. But is the new law, in your estimation, just kind of catching up with technology, and is technology already further down the road?
Well, that's also a good question. You know, it's hard to keep up with technology these days. Every day that goes by, there's something new that's being developed. In some cases, it's additional distracting devices that drivers are carrying into the vehicle with them. In other cases, it's technology that's being developed that will help minimize that distraction. You know, if we look at some of the new technology that's coming out related to texting, there's systems that are being developed and starting to be deployed that allow you to text without actually having to do manual entry. And so they'll read your text message to you, and then you can read back your response, and they will take that verbal message and convert it into text.
Well, and some of this is voice recognition technology then.
Yeah, voice recognition. And is that
better?
It's better than manual entry, yes.
But can you still drive and do that?
That's one of the questions. Right now, there's research going on that's looking at that. From a theoretical standpoint, it should be infinitely better. However, one of the things we do know that from a research standpoint is that even with the voice recognition, there's still a tendency for drivers to look at where the microphone is at, even though there's no need to. It's this interpersonal necessity. If you hear a voice and you try to respond to it, you naturally try and take it into a conversation mode. And you identify where the messages are coming from, and you have a tendency to look there. And if that takes your eyes off the road, that's not a good thing.
Does it also take – I'm going back to this cognitive in your title here – also take your mind off the road?
It does, and that's one of the challenges. When you get into the verbal cognitive interactions, mm-hmm. they're a little more nebulous to try and study. And we're doing a study right now that'll be starting here in the next couple of months, where we're going to take a look at one of those approaches and looking at how do drivers do on that particular type of distraction. And so it's an interesting question. There's research going on. There's been some done that shows promise, but there's a lot more to be done to understand from a pure safety standpoint and thoroughly research that area.
Well, the natural question here, does this law go far enough?
That's again, I've got my researcher hat on, and then there's this, you know, the legislature has a different job than researchers do. You know, researchers, yeah. I've got the advantage. I can go into the laboratory and we can design a study and we can answer a question. And then there's the question from a public policy standpoint, what needs to be done? And I think that, you know, you could make an argument that, you know, one of the things that doesn't allow laws is GPS entry. And we know that that's dangerous.
I'm going to bring James, who's driving on the road here right now and doing exactly what we're talking about. James?
Yes.
Give us your question.
Okay. I'm a professional truck driver, and we're always on call out there on making certain stops. And I have what you call Bluetooth. You just put it in your ear. I'm always doing my scanning. I'm watching my speed limit. I'm 42 years old. I was 30 years old when I first got my cell phone. And I understand these kids nowadays, they text the road, which I know is wrong. So I was wondering if there's any way possible if they could put something into a vehicle that will stop them from doing this in the future.
Well, if you heard the question there.
I did hear the question, and that gets very complicated. I think from a technological standpoint, that's something that is possible. One of the things that's out there from a new technology standpoint is the ability to detect whether or not someone's distracted. So if the vehicle's going down the road, how do I know whether or not the driver is distracted? And there's different things you can do. And
who can do?
That the driver can do. You know, they could be eating a cheeseburger as they're driving down the road, and that's going to distract them. They could be have their mind off of the driving task, thinking about what's going on at school or what's going on at work. And you know, some of the work we're doing is to try and develop algorithms that will help predict whether or not the driver is distracted or not. And those could be used to potentially disable some of these distracting devices. But the problem is a lot of these things are carry-in devices. And so if they're not integrated with the vehicle, it's hard to do much about them.
Well, James, do you feel that Bluetooth allows you to keep your mind on the road and still talk?
Yes, I do. I mean, everybody has their own opinion, but like I said, I look at all my mirrors. I look in front of me. I'm not holding anything in my hands. I'm aware of my surroundings. I'm driving a 53-foot truck. Mm-hmm. I feel confident, but if I feel there's a situation, I'll just pour off my ear and set it down.
James, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
And thank you, Tim. We're coming up to the end of the segment.
It's
been a pleasure. Thanks for your views, professional insight into this new law. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about another new law, and that is gun control. This is The Exchange. Dean Borg again, The Exchange continuing, and we're going to be talking, as I said just a moment ago, about a new law effective July 1st that follows federal law and taking gun rights away from individuals who are under court order to stay away from another person, and also some other nuances there. We're going to be talking with Amber Markham, who is Director of Public Policy for the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and Samantha O'Hara, who is the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy instructor who specializes in violence against women. Hello, Amber. Hello, Samantha.
Hello. Good afternoon.
As I've given the overview here about the court order staying away from another person, we call that protection, a protective order. The law also permanently takes away gun rights from anyone convicted of domestic abuse. Amber, I would speculate that this is a legislative priority, has been for you. How will it help what you do in the Coalition Against Domestic Violence?
Well, this legislation is going to be instrumental in helping victims of domestic violence. Although we've had the federal law in place for years, unfortunately, the federal law that banned possession of firearms for those convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence or those qualifying for a or those subject to a qualifying protective order, were never turning over their guns. So we had the law in place under federal law, but we had no way to enforce it under state law. And so this is going to allow us to enforce this, the firearms ban with state law rather than relying on only two ATF agents across the state to enforce the federal law. So it's really going to help enforce a law that was really already in place, but it's just going to put teeth into that law.
So teeth is what, and enough teeth there?
You know, I think so. Certainly, you know, there's always more that we could ask for. But basically, right now, you know, it was confusing to judges. It was confusing to law enforcement as to what role they had in enforcing a federal law. Because this is now state law, it's far more clear that they have the authority and the right to go and make sure that those firearms are turned in when they're supposed to be.
Ms. O'Hara is instructor of police officers on matters of violence against women. How will this change what you teach?
Well, right now, when officers across the state of Iowa come across someone who is possessing firearms after being convicted of a crime of misdemeanor, domestic violence, or subject to a restraining order, they can seize that weapon for safekeeping, but essentially they conduct an investigation, put a bow on it, and ask for the federal prosecutors to go forward with the prosecution. Now, after July 1st, that authority for prosecuting that crime rests with the state. So the state and their local county attorneys can go forward with these types of offenses, investigating and fully prosecuting these offenses. So we don't have to sit silent or hopeful for our federal prosecutors to be able to take the large number of cases that come across their desks every year.
And I'm going to ask in just a moment then, does it change anything that you teach? And before you answer that, I want to give the telephone number here, 1-866-780-9100 for anyone who has a question about this new gun control law relating to domestic abuse. Ms. O'Hara?
It changes the way we teach at the academy just in a little bit, in a slightly different way. There's been a law in the books for a number of years for felon in possession of firearms. This new state law essentially expands the prohibition of felons from possessing firearms to those of misdemeanors, misdemeanants convicted of domestic violence are subject to qualifying restraining orders similarly. So a violation of this new offense will similarly be a Class D felony. Mm-hmm. And again, you have to do, you know, similar types of investigation, you know, warrants, arrests, and things like that, just like you do for a felon in possession, a firearms type of case. So it's very similar. It builds on what we already do at the academy in terms of teaching our officers the appropriate steps in an investigation. But I guess another important aspect here is that this is not a brand new concept. Many, many states actually mirror this federal prohibition against the possession of firearms by prohibited people, specifically misdemeanants convicted of domestic violence. So what the state of Iowa has done is gotten into step with other states who have embraced this idea, and so allow the officers in the state of Iowa to be able to go forward with their investigations independent of federal involvement in the prosecution of those offenses.
Amber and Samantha, one of you referred to large numbers. How many cases are you talking about that this new law would affect?
Well, it's hard to determine exactly how many cases this new law would affect because generally, I guess, speaking, it's already federal law, so anyone who couldn't possess a firearm under federal law can't now possess it under state law. So technically, they should have already had their firearms turned into the appropriate law enforcement officers. It's only those people who chose not to follow the federal law and were breaking the federal law to begin with that now potentially, you know, would be subject to the new state law and would have to turn their firearm in. But I think just generally, since 1995, we've had more than 200 Iowans killed in domestic violence murders. 111 of those were killed with a gun. So it's the number one leading cause of domestic violence homicide is murder by a firearm. And so for us, there are a lot of cases dealing for domestic violence that, you know, that will be subject to this new law and will help a lot of victims. So.
Who does it really protect? Is it the person who is the victim of domestic abuse, or are police also protected by this? That is, taking guns away from people who have a grudge.
Well, I think that that's kind of a two-part answer, and I'll just answer the first part. It definitely protects victims of domestic violence because we've seen that victims of domestic violence aren't only murdered by firearms, but their lives are controlled by their abusers having a firearm. Mm-hmm. So if they want to, you know, move on with their life, leave, not live in fear, that's very difficult for them to do in a situation where they know their abuser has a firearm and potentially has threatened to use it against them.
Keon is calling from Waterloo. I'm going to bring Keon on. A question?
Yeah. Not that I don't, agree with the spouse abuse law, but doesn't this law seem like it's a little bit over the top? Because that's essentially saying if somebody did something 20 years ago and since then they've changed their life, you're still lumping them in, making them feel like a felon.
Okay. I have a question, Amber.
Sure. If they were convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence in the past, this law would apply to them, so they would be subject to the firearms ban. However, if they were convicted of that crime since 1994, they would have already had to have had their firearms turned in under federal law, so they wouldn't have been able to possess a firearm regardless of if this state law passed or not.
Thank you, Keon, for that question. A question that I have, too. Does this law simply give another tool, though, to law enforcement officers to lock up an individual on a more serious charge? That is, he or she may have just have a protective order ordering them to stay away from somebody, but if they get caught with a gun, they're locked up.
Absolutely. It essentially, like I tried to indicate, is that it provides those resources for officers to address the situation immediately, as opposed to waiting for weeks or months down the road for federal prosecutors to get on board the case. But you definitely allow officers the ability to react immediately, investigate the offense, which is a felony, to possess a weapon, possess a firearm after conviction of misdemeanor crime of domestic violence or subject to a protective order, which an adjudicatory hearing had been held. It absolutely gives more of an immediate option for law enforcement officers. And the end result there is to try to ensure that we try to keep the victims in our state as safe as possible.
Amber, can I just address that question?
Yes.
I just want to say, too, that it's really important to note that there are two separate crimes taking place here. The first crime would be that you were convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. Just because you were convicted of that crime does not mean then you will automatically be convicted of a Class D felony for not turning in your firearm. It's only if you choose to commit the second crime of not turning in that firearm that then you can be subject to prosecution for that Class D felony. So I just want to make clear that it is two separate, actions and crimes, and that you can't be prosecuted for a Class D felony simply because you were convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. It's only if you choose not to turn in your firearm afterwards.
But isn't the end result that we're going to have more people in jail because they didn't follow the letter of the law?
Possibly that absolutely could happen. Since this has been federal law on the books since at least 1994, I think that the state of Iowa passing this legislation effective July 1st will increase awareness of it for some of those folks who didn't realize that their 1996 conviction of misdemeanor crime of domestic violence precludes them from possessing weapons. I think that, getting the word out and sharing this information with the citizens of Iowa will help people understand that they haven't had that ability to legally possess those weapons for some time. But it's certainly not under state law either after July 1st.
I have to go. Thanks so much, Amber and Samantha.
Thank
you. This is The Exchange on Public Radio. And I'm Dean Borg, continuing The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. And we're going to be talking now with State Senator Rob Hoag of Cedar Rapids. Among all the guests today, Senator Hoag, you're the one who knows the story behind the headlines because you helped write the law and took part in legislative debate on both sides of the question. You heard both sides, and then you voted on these new laws. So we need your expertise.
Well, good afternoon, Dean, and I'm happy to be on the show.
Say, I want to ask you, first of all, we just finished a discussion on the new laws on gun rights, on taking away gun rights from individuals who are under court order to stay away from another person who's under a protective order, and then permanently it takes away gun rights from anyone convicted of domestic abuse. You may have heard our conversation on that with Amber Markham, and Samantha O'Hare, two people who specialize in violence against women. Did the Supreme Court decision earlier this week relating to gun control laws enacted by the city of Chicago, did that at all worry you about where Iowa is in this new law?
Well, Dean, I'm not too concerned about that for a couple reasons. First of all, what we have done in the state legislation there was modeled after what the federal government has done. And the second thing is, my understanding of that Supreme Court decision is all they said in that decision was that state and local gun laws could be subjected to a review under the Second Amendment, incorporated against the states under the 14th Amendment. They haven't said how that review is going to proceed. Mm-hmm. And so it's still pretty early in the judicial process on that case. And obviously it's something we'll take a look at later on, but for now I don't think it's a problem with this legislation.
I'm going to go on then to other things that you're really concerned about, and that is floodplain mapping. That is a new law taking effect on July 1st. You're from Cedar Rapids, enough said. 2008, the floods there. But what is flood mapping, floodplain mapping?
Well, on the floodplain mapping, what we've done in the last two legislative sessions, one is we've required all cities and counties that have an identifiable flood hazard area to participate in the National Flood Insurance Program, which requires flood mapping and then also makes available to the citizens in those cities and counties the opportunity to buy flood insurance. So that's something we had passed in 2009. The legislation we passed this year directed some federal funds to the Flood Center at the University of Iowa to update those maps. One of the real challenges we've had adopting policy on regulating the floodplain is a lot of uncertainty about the quality of our flood maps. You can have a line drawn down a street, same elevation on each side of the street, but part of it's out of the 100-year floodplain, part of it's in the 100-year floodplain. So we have directed money over 4 years, federal funds that we had access to over 4 years, to the Flood Center at the University of Iowa to develop standardized, high-quality maps for the entire state.
What does that mean? They're going to be going out to Mason City, Cedar Rapids, and all points in between on that Cedar River and the basin that feeds into that. And yep. I'm just giving eastern Iowa points here right now. The same could be said of the Raccoon in central Iowa and elsewhere. Does that mean that you're going to send teams out across the state and map these communities?
Well, it's not exactly. They are going to be working with communities on the maps, but we have also been in the process of photographically determining the elevations in the state, a process called LIDAR. And so the Flood Center will be working with that data to show how floodwaters propagate through a community to help come up with better flood maps that are more usable, that are more accurate, and will work. And you mentioned the communities in the Cedar River watershed, which is obviously my primary concern since I represent Cedar Rapids. But the states, out in the Little Sioux River, Cherokee apparently got hammered pretty hard. Webster City got hammered pretty hard on the Boone River in the last week. And I think the floodwaters are still a major concern as they go down through the Des Moines River watershed. So we're hoping for the best this week, and I hope the Des Moines neighborhoods can survive as well.
But will this new law, even as, at this point in time, as you say, with flooding taking place in north central Iowa and on down those tributaries into the main basin through Des Moines and so on, do you think that this new law is coming into effect so that lessons can be learned even now?
Oh, there's no question. This is why, after the 2008 flood, I made a personal commitment and have gotten great legislative support on this, that we needed to pursue a series of policies to say never again to the flood damage that we experienced in 2008. And I would just mention a couple other things that we did pass this year. that take effect this week. One is we passed a smart planning bill that addresses not just disaster mitigation, but other forms of land use planning, but to lay out some smart planning principles that include a special focus on disaster mitigation and flood hazard mitigation. And that's a tool now that's available for cities and counties across our state. And as an incentive to get communities involved in the smart planning process, we put a pool of money out through iJobs of $30 million for disaster prevention grants. So a city or a county that wants to adopt smart planning, wants to proactively protect their critical facilities, their governmental facilities from future flood damage, they can apply for that money. And I believe those applications are expected to be in as early as August.
And so this is something in planning. You say there's money for planning right now, but the effects, and I'm not saying this is bad, but there's a big time lag here. We're only in the planning stage right now. We won't see the effects or the assistance or the help that this new law gives for another decade or so.
Well, Dean, part of that is true. Obviously, as you do planning, as you do mapping, some of those effects won't be seen for a decade or more. I mean, that's good long-range planning by the state. But the resources we're putting out now for communities that need financial help to take proactive measures to protect themselves, those are dollars that we expect to be seen as part of the iJobs program starting this fall. And something that, you know, even in Cedar Rapids, as we're rebuilding, one of the requirements of a lot of the rebuilding has been that it needs to be floodproof. So, for example, we got financial assistance for our county administration building, the public service center this session to help us rebuild our county government building, our city hall, our Veterans Memorial auditorium. Those things are really, really important so that not only can we rebuild, but we're rebuilding smarter and safer mm-hmm. so that if another disaster happens before we've got more permanent flood protection in place, the damage will be significantly less. And the thing about this disaster prevention grant program that we have statewide is really something that any city or any county in the state that has a hazard, that's engaged in better planning, those cities and counties can apply now and try to get the financial help they need to floodproof and it's not just flooding. It's also we're also talking about tornadoes and making safe rooms in our buildings throughout the state.
What is the State Department that's administering? Where do those applications go? If people who are listening from communities that are, as you say, have flooding hazards, where is it? The Department of Natural Resources?
No, the money is flowing through the Iowa Finance Authority. So they would contact the Iowa Finance Authority, or they can look on site at the iJobs website. It's ijobsiowa.gov.
And this is only, though, for municipalities or governmental entities. This is not for individual landowners.
That is correct. This money is focused at the city and county government level so that communities across our state can hopefully avoid the problems we had in Cedar Rapids in the 2008 flood, where, you know, in addition to the 5,000 homes and 800 businesses that were flooded, we lost about 80% of our governmental buildings, at least for a short period of time, and some of them are still closed. Our central fire station here in Cedar Rapids is still closed, and that's 2 years after the flood.
I might ask, does the law go far enough to make a real difference in potential flooding? You know, where you're just studying the situation now and providing essential money for good planning, but how do you plan to finance then what the studies show is needed?
Well, Dean, that's obviously going to be an issue for a future date. I will tell you, though, as a state senator from Cedar Rapids, I know there's a lot more we need to do. We considered legislation this year that did not pass, a legislation that would have strengthened floodplain regulations, for example, updated stormwater management standards and promulgated those statewide, protections for critical facilities from a 500-year flood event. We considered a number of things. Those didn't have the support this year to pass, but they remain out there, and we'll continue to talk about that. You know, we have to have a fair amount of urgency about this, and I agree with that. At the same time, we all know it's going to take a few years. So the key for me is let's make progress every year, and if we continually make progress over the next 5 to 10 years, I think we can get Iowa in a position where we are much safer than we were before the floods of 2008.
Well, let's go from floodwaters to the highways and law enforcement and fines for exceeding speed limits. You made some major changes there as a legislator.
We did, Dean. We passed a series of fine increases, and I, you know, everybody can get worried about them. The fines went up by differential amounts based on an assessment of what we thought as the severity of the offenses. So, for example, the fine for speeding but exceeding the speed limit by more than 20 miles per hour in an under 55 zone, which is very hazardous to do that. That fine went up by more than some of the other fines, but we...
In fact, it just about doubled.
I believe we doubled that one. Other fines might have only gone up by $10. But a couple things on this. One, this was an update. With inflation, as things change, if it had been 10 years since we've raised a particular fine, maybe it was time to raise that fine. The second thing is we used all of this money that's going to be collected from the fines for public safety enforcement purposes, to help the state troopers, to help the correctional system, to help the court system. And we really needed that money to avoid layoffs in those areas. So I think it was a reasonable increase. It was an update. And as I like to say, if you don't want to pay the fine, don't do the crime. Let's be careful out there.
You sort of answered the question I was going to ask, and that is this a hope for deterrent in helping people change their mindset and whether or not to speed or commit other offenses, or is it a way to raise more money for the state?
And the answer is it's both. We clearly needed some revenue to avoid layoffs in the correction system and make sure we were funding state troopers in the court system to avoid more layoffs there. But it is also a deterrent function, it's an old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and there's no question that we continue to try to drive down the number of accidents and fatalities on our roadways, and to the extent that listeners hear this, they know that fines are going to be higher, they decide to drive more carefully, boy, that's a good thing for our state.
Senator Hoag, thanks so much for spending time with us today. State Senator Rob Hoag from Cedar Rapids.
Thanks, Dean.
And we're going to move right now into another new laws. And this one increases state funding for preschool in Iowa. Adds about state funding for 4,500, I think the number is, new preschool children. And we're going to be talking with Rachel Tegler, who is a preschool teacher at Trinity Lane Preschool in Cedar Rapids, and with Sue Wolf, who is the director of Trinity Lane Preschool. Rachel and Sue, hello.
Hi. Hi.
Now, this new law, as I said, adds about 4,500 new preschool children. Does it affect you, Sue, at all, as the director of Trinity Lane Preschool?
The new law does not affect us because we are still under contract with the Cedar Rapids Community School District for 15 children Monday through Friday from 9 to 12 in the morning.
And that's something there that I want to explore. You said that you're under contract.
Uh-huh.
So that means that you probably are a privately operated preschool.
That's correct. We are part of the Lovely Lane Children's Weekday Ministries that is operated by Lovely Lane United Methodist Church here in Cedar Rapids.
And before state funding of preschool, which allowed the Cedar Rapids District then to contract with you, you had about the same number of children?
That's correct. I should probably make clear that just our 4 year old class is under contract with Cedar Rapids. We still have a three year old class on Monday, Wednesday, and Tuesday, Thursday, and a twos class for two-year-olds on Monday, Wednesday, and Tuesday, Thursday. So, and those are not part of the voluntary preschool program. Mm-hmm.
Rachel Tegeler, you're a preschool teacher there at Trinity Lane. How have you noticed any difference at all as you have contracted in the last few years? And I don't know, how many years has it been, three or four?
I've been the four-year-old teacher for 2 years. Mm-hmm. I was previously the two-year-old teacher for three, so I've been with Trinity Lane for 5 years total. As far as changes, it has allowed us as a preschool to get more materials that help our students learn better. It's allowed us to take some field trips that we couldn't take before, which gives them more experiences. It's also allowed me as a teacher to have more professional development. I'm allowed to go to every professional development trainings that all of the Cedar Rapids Public School District teachers go to. It's also given us money and funding to actually purchase a curriculum that has been research-based, where before we kind of just sort of came together with our own kind of thing based upon pulling from various areas. So it's helped a lot in that way. It helps me as a teacher to be able to better assess my kids and kind of help them grow and develop more.
I want to explore those things that you've mentioned there more fully, but I'd like to ask Sue, as director of Trinity Lane Preschool there in Cedar Rapids and the contract that you have, how much money does this mean for you coming from the state through the Cedar Rapids School District? What is your annual income from that grant?
You know, Dean, I can't speak to that right now. I don't have the contract in front of me. Let me tell you that it does allow us to pay for a licensed teacher, and we have a budget for some supplies, and like Rachel said, the field trips. And I think it's probably, I would say, in the range of around $40,000 a year.
Do your students pay tuition?
No. This is a free this is part of the voluntary preschool program. The fours do not pay any registration fees or tuition, but we still are a private preschool.
But does it? Are you selective then, according to income?
We aren't. Now I understand that some of the the Cedar Rapids School District does give preference to children that are at or below the poverty guidelines, but we go ahead and take anyone who applies.
Rachel, you mentioned several benefits and the things that you do that you can see in the children. Tell me more about the value of preschool that you can discern. Why should taxpayers be paying for preschool?
Well, there's a ton of research out there as far as the benefits of early learning programs across the world. The earlier that we work with these students, the better prepared they are for school. They are able to have things at their fingertips that they wouldn't necessarily have. So many more children are in child care centers today than they used to be. It allows them to have a quality place to go, as a place that's safe. We build a lot on their social skills. Research shows that kids that come out of preschool, they have a higher retaining in high school. There's not as much a dropout from them. There's less crime. So in the long run, it really saves society a lot of money because we're not paying for things, crimes and things that are happening when these children grow up. Also, it allows us to identify children that might have special needs early on. A lot of these kids, maybe if they're at home or if they're even in another child care setting or a preschool setting where the teachers just haven't had the ability to get the education to really know what to look for, they're not identified until they come to kindergarten. And the earlier, everything we know about brain research tells us that the earlier that we are able to have intervention with students with special needs, the less likely they'll need help later on.
Tell me, how do you notice and how do you gauge growth from the student who comes in as a four-year-old at the beginning of the year and when you, quote, graduate that student?
That's all a part of, we use, the district has chosen creative curriculum, which I believe pretty much nearly every district, not everyone, but nearly every district across the state has been using creative curriculum. There's a couple of others that are research-based as well, but that curriculum,
looks at their social and emotional development, their physical development, their cognitive, which is like their pre-math, pre-science types of skills, thinking skills, and their language and literacy skills. And it's based on all the research that has gone on for years and years on how children grow and learn and develop. And so there's 50 different objectives under that that we look at every single one of those. And I do take observations every day. I observe what my kids are doing and watch them, how they're playing, how they're interacting, the languages that they're using, the questions they're able to answer or not able to answer. And we use that as our guide.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to do that whole assessment, and then we look at that, and that says, okay, well, this is where this child is falling on this developmental
continuum.
So
you do have measurement. I want to squeeze a question in here for Sue Wolf, who's the director there at Trinity Lane. Is there at all provision for special education students as four-year-olds?
Oh, we are partners with Cedar Rapids under a different program, the least restrictive environment, in which we have children that are with us. Well, we usually have two or three children in a classroom that do have special needs. And if they are identified in a voluntary preschool program, in our Forest program, there's provisions made for that as well.
So you do then.
Uh-huh, yes, well, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Sue Wolf, Director of Trinity Lane, and Rachel Tegler, who is a preschool teacher there. Thanks so much.
Thanks,
for
Dean.
Your comments.
Thank you.
Well, The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, and Alex Hauer. The production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Dennis Reese. We would like to have your comments. The music is composed and performed by Dan Knight, and this is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
Coming up next on